There's few who do it like Ray Charles. Hey, reminder, we serve a God that is a God over all the nations, not just ours, right? God is not an American God. He is bigger than that. So let's not confuse patriotism for nationalism and worshiping our country above our God. That being said, we live in a pretty stinking awesome place. Now, granted, this country was started with a hope of every man living with unalienable rights under God. We have not lived up to that the way we should in some seasons of this country's history. And to deny that is to deny the reality of injustice that has happened in our country. That being said, the hope of this country is not that we're defined by where we've been, but that we might live up to those ideals, as Dr. King called that promissory note of what justice could look like, of each man being judged not by the color of their skin, but the content of their character. And so I'm hopeful, and I share that in very divided times. And so this will be, as I mentioned, a test of our joyful confidence in God, whether you're stoked right now as to who might be in the White House or whether you're not, whether you think it's done or whether you think there's a legal option for us, it doesn't matter. God is going to be God. He is sovereign over it all. And we need to be faithful regardless of that outcome. I share that simply to say this. We have an opportunity together to live out what I think the founding fathers really hoped we would be under God. And the only way that happens is if we take our lives and submit it to the scriptures. And so today we've got a special guest. Considering it is Veterans Day, we thought we'd do something a little unique. And I want to introduce our MC here and interviewer for the day. You know him as the voice of the Bulldogs. What you may not know is this guy has a heart for understanding and uncovering and really capturing the heart of veterans in this city and all over for that matter. He not only is an athletic mind who knows all the stats and the stat rat and the sweet, smooth voice of the Bulldogs. But he's also a guy who cares deeply about our country and has invested hours and hours and hours of his life capturing the stories of incredible men who have served our country faithfully. So would you give it up for Paul Loeffler?
Thanks for the kind words, Brad. When you said athletic mind, I thought you were going to say athletic basketball player, but I was...
Well, I thought about it.
Well,
I got a little tongue-tied. You've never had that happen, though, have you?
All the time. And I've never been this well-dressed at the well today, but there's a very good reason for it, and you'll see that in a second. You know, just listening to what Brad was just sharing about our country and, you know, how divided we've been, the most amazing thing to me over the last 10, 15 years is to see the power of our veterans to bring us together. And if any of you have ever been to one of our honor flight events, you see that, where you see age 0 to 100, you see every ethnicity, every religious belief, every tax bracket, every political persuasion, and it doesn't matter. There's one thing we agree on, is that our veterans deserve our gratitude, because we know we wouldn't have what we have without their service and their sacrifice. So before I say anything else, I've got to find out how many veterans we have in the room here today. Anybody who's ever served, raise your hand if you can. All right. Thank you for serving our country. And I've got to keep an eye on the time, because if I get going telling you a bunch of stories, I mean, we'll be here all morning. I want you to get the real deal. You're going to meet someone who's one of my heroes this morning. But I just want to throw a little background on there. There's so much power in our veteran stories. There's power to inspire us. I just talked about the power of uniting us. But there's also, for me, the power of the gospel on display. If you come to the well on Sundays, you hear Brad talk about the shadows of Jesus throughout the Bible. And in hearing some of these veteran stories, I see shadows of the gospel, of how Christ laid his life down for us and told us, greater love has no man than this, that he laid down his life for his friends. And anybody who's ever worn that uniform was willing to make that choice, whether you had to or not, you were willing to do that. Just a few of the stories that I want to share with you this morning, I'll get into in a second. But I often get asked, well, why did you guys start Honor Flight, or where did that come from, or how'd you get into talking to veterans? So I want to tell you a little story of growing up in Las Banas, the center of the universe, by the way. Why are you guys laughing? My grandpa was a really cool guy. He was a doctor. I knew a lot about him, but I didn't know anything about what he did in the service. And one day, I was playing hide and seek, and my brother was about to catch me, and I'm trying to escape from this closet, and I got my shirt caught on something in the corner of this closet. So I turned it away. It was a frame facing the wall. So I turned it back around, and it says, it's a newspaper from Chicago in 1944, and it says in big red letters, Chicagoan Saves 26. And it was about my grandpa pulling 26 men out of burning tanks in France. He got a Silver Star for it. And I was like, wow, I'd like to hear that story someday. And that always kind of stuck with me. And years later, when I was doing television and you see all these stories on the news of a stabbing, a shooting, a fire, a scandal, all the stuff that drags you down, I'm thinking, what kind of stories can we tell that lift us up? And my thought was, maybe I can get my grandpa's story. There were 16 million guys who served in World War II, and none of them ever talked about it. Maybe I can get some of their stories. And eventually, I had the chance to do that. And there's one thing that happened when I interviewed my grandpa that I want to share with you real quick, because maybe it relates to some of you guys in the room. I was asking him about that incident when he pulled 26 guys out of burning tanks. And what happened was the German 88s hit the front of their column, and they hit the back of their column, and there was nowhere to turn around, so every vehicle in between was just a sitting duck, and they were just picking them off. And so everyone was trying to take cover, and my grandpa and his Jeep driver kept going back in and pulling guys out. So I said, if everybody else was getting out of there and you guys kept going back in, what in the world were you thinking? He said, what was I thinking? I thought I was going to get killed. And I said, well, I'm glad you didn't. And he said, yeah, you wouldn't be around. And I did the same thing. I laughed, right? And then I was like, whoa, that's for real. That's true. I would have never been born. And I'm sure there's a lot of other people in this room that regardless of where your dad or your grandfather may have served, or even other things in life that could have claimed that life, you wouldn't be here right now. So that's something that always stays with me. And every veteran that I talk to, I listen for that and I look for that. There's always something. There was a moment, whether he moved off the ship that sunk a week later, or, you know, you're going to see a picture in a few minutes of a helmet with two bullet holes in it. Figure out how that guy survived. There's so many stories of what could have been, but God's mercy and God's grace and God's plans in the lives of these veterans, whether they know the Lord or not, are always evident to me. And I want to give you a couple quick examples before I bring up my friend here. A lot of you guys have probably heard, you've seen the movie Unbroken, read that book. Louis Zamperini, of course. And here, you know, he makes a deal. He crashes. He's on the water for 47 days floating in a raft, and he's picked up by the Japanese. He's tortured. He's a prisoner for years. But he had made a deal with God. If you get me out of this, I'm going to serve you. And he gets back home, and he's not keeping up with that. He's going through a divorce. He goes to a Billy Graham crusade. He gets saved. Ends up becoming a missionary and going back to Japan and finding the guys who tortured him and forgiving him. I don't think that story happens without God, right? Only God could write a story like that. But there's examples like that that have been right here in our community. Another one of my favorites was a guy named Dr. Stan Lindquist. He got blown up in a minefield in Germany. The whole time he'd been writing letters back to his wife to turn into a church newsletter that went out to servicemen all over the world trying to encourage him. He even wrote them ahead of time in case something like that happened to him. Then he almost dies. He loses an eye. He loses his leg. But he survives, and he comes back here, and something God had put on his heart was that our pastors and missionaries need counseling. If you know any pastors or missionaries, you probably know that's a true statement. We all can use that time, you know, from time to time. So he started something called Link Care that's here in Fresno, and that has provided counseling to more missionaries than any organization around the world, and continues to provide free counseling for pastors in our community when they're in need. So what a story God had for Dr. Stan. Good thing he saved him in World War II. Another guy who's here in town, maybe he was some of your guys' pastor, a guy by the name of George Hansen, pastored at River Park Bible Church for many years. His story was that growing up in church, they'd always say, hey, who wants to be a missionary? And he would never raise his hand, and that was the last thing he was going to do. And then he finds himself in the Battle of the Bulge, and a shell comes into the half track he's riding in, and it kills the guy here and the guy here, and it landed right between his legs, but his big, heavy winter jacket absorbed most of the shrapnel, and he survived. And he said, okay, God, if you get me through this, I'll do anything you tell me to do, even if I have to be a missionary. Ends up a missionary in Brazil for 25 years. and the work of that continues. I mean, I could go on and on and on. I heard a story yesterday, and I've heard this probably but from five or six veterans over the years, guys who in a severe crisis on the other side of the world would find out later when they got home, their mother would say, "Hey, where in this guy's case, where were you on August 5th? He said, "I was in Tokyo. That's the day that our ship turned over and should have gone under, and we miraculously came back up, and I survived." And she said, "What time was that?" And they figured out the exact same time that he was going through that, she was moved at 2:30 in the morning to get out of her bed and go pray for her son. And I've heard that story from, seriously, five, six, seven veterans over the years telling it convincingly and passionately. And you know there's something more than the imagination at work. Another guy that is a friend of the gentleman you're going to meet here in a moment. If you're from Dinuba, maybe you knew a guy named Jonas Hofer, who had a music store there for many years. Here's a guy who almost died running off the road to Hume Lake as a teenager, was paralyzed from the waist down, put up monkey bars in his house to swing around the house, and his back straightens out, he's able to walk again, becomes a pole vaulter of all things. That's miraculous in itself. But he's in World War II. They have a thing called the Navigators. Some of you guys have used the Navigators to memorize Bible verses. So he's trying to start this Christian club, if you will, on his ship, and the chaplain won't let him meet. They find out the chaplain was drinking all the communion wine on the ship, and he gets kicked off the ship, and Jonas gets to lead a Bible study. And then the ship sinks, and all these guys who've been making fun of him for being a holy roller are trying to find him to hang on to him in the water, and they start singing hymns in the water while they're floating there, not knowing if anyone's ever going to pick him up. I mean, these stories, you think about what we've been through, and I think they take us to a different perspective. They take us to a point that maybe you guys have ended up in your life in where you know you're in such a desperate place, there's nowhere else to turn but God, and maybe we should be there more often. There's one more story I want to share before I bring up Vern, and this is one I just became familiar with last year, and I really wished I would have known it a lot sooner. You know, when I mentioned John 15:13, "And greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends," there are so many examples of that I've heard over the years, but this one hit really close to home. Since I do get to call the Bulldog games and tell story about people like Brad or the guy who's gloating over the Dodgers over here, Chris Pacheco. Did you get your donuts yet? Rusty said he was sending you donuts to pay up a bet, by the way. But we had, in the 1940s, almost every Fresno State football player, and they had some really good teams, almost every one of them ended up in World War II. And not all of them came back. And last year, I just learned the story of these two Fresno State football teammates. Their names were Gene Streeter and Chuck Houston. And I got to hear the story from the one who survived, Chuck Houston. These guys play football. They're at Fresno and Roosevelt. Imagine that if you know the rivalry, right? Fresno and Roosevelt in high school. They come to Fresno State. They play football for the Bulldogs. Then Pearl Harbor happens, and they both immediately sign up. They both become Navy pilots. Believe it or not, they both end up flying F-6F Hellcats off the very same aircraft carrier in the war. The odds of that, you know, not very likely. So they're flying together. And one day they're flying, and they hear a radio call that there's this torpedo plane with six people on board that is out of ammunition. And then they see it, and they see three Japanese Zeros heading for it. Now Chuck, the one friend, was engaged with the Japanese plane already. He couldn't go over. But this other guy, Gene Streeter, this former Fresno State football player, flew in his fighter plane, is a little more agile than the torpedo plane that was out of ammunition. And his one plane, he took on all three of those Japanese planes. So that the damaged torpedo plane was able to get away, and all of those guys survived. This Gene Streeter shoots down two of the Japanese planes, and then the third one shot him down, and he went into the water and was never found. So if you read his citation for the Navy Cross, which is second only to the Medal of Honor, you'll read where they say that he gallantly gave his life for his country, and I don't think you could argue with that. So what better example of the gospel, of laying your life down, than stories like that? But what I get fired up about is when I get to meet these guys, I see a living, breathing example, and I want to call one of those guys up right now. That's why I'm wearing the suit today, because he told me he was going to wear his coat that he wears every Veterans Day. If we had a parade today, you'd see him in the parade. He's the commander of our local chapter of the American Ex-Prisoners of War, and I want to bring him up right here. One of my all-time favorites, Vern Schmidt. Let's give Vern a hand. Vern's going to be 95 in January. When I picked him up this morning, he got into the car faster and more smoothly than I did. I mean, this guy is something. Have a seat, Vern, if you can. And actually, I have some photographic evidence that this was once an 18-year-old guy in the Army. Let's take a look at that, huh? Can you guys all see? Can you see Vern up there? You recognize that guy, Vern? No, you don't have to get out of the way.
April 6th.
Use your microphone.
That's taken April 6, 1945. The 90th Division happenstance to find the Merkers gold mine, which is two big salt mines there. One is 1,500 feet below the ground. The other one is 2,400 feet below. And one of our guys intercepted a couple of women who were violating a curfew at night. And asked, you ladies aren't supposed to be out here. And this lady says, look, I'm taking this woman. She's pregnant. I'm taking her to the midwife so we can deliver. But she said, you know, you need to go over there and check where that derrick is. There's something there because trucks come almost every day and unload stuff. I've been down in there twice. There is gold bullion. There was gold bullion in there into the millions. There was millions of American $100 bills in there, all stolen by the German high command and brought there to hide, thinking when the war is over, we can bring back up. And they had paintings, Van Gogh and some of these famous painters, they lined up in there. And I'm thinking, Our division almost changed the concept of what was happening. Our two-star general called General Bradley. Bradley called Patton. Patton called Eisenhower. They all came down there and went down the elevator. Here was a four-star general, a three-star general, and a two-star general. All went down there. And if you know George Patton, I served under him. I've met him one time. He made a statement to Eisenhower. He said, what if this elevator cracks and we all get killed? He said, there'd be a real shakeup in the brass, wouldn't there? Anyway, that's where that happened.
If you guys have ever seen that movie, The Monuments Men, that's what he's talking about. This is the true story, and he lived it. And you just mentioned General Patton. Why don't you tell everybody where you stay when you go over to Europe? Who do you stay with?
General Patton's granddaughter, Helen Patton, she wanted to do something for Grandpa. And so she started the foundation, the General Patton Foundation, over in Europe. And now there's one here in the States. And in fact, there's two museums in honor of General Patton also. One is in Mount Scirocco, not too far from here. If you go to Palm Springs and head east, you go over a little hill called Mount Scirocco. General Patton was, in 1942, was asked to find a training area, and he went down there, landed a little Cub airplane, and began to put the area together. It became the nation's largest armor training center in the whole United States out there. There's a beautiful museum to honor General Patton there now, and then also one on the East Coast. But Helen is just a beautiful lady. She has several homes, and she bought a French chateau, and we've been there, and Vern says, I've got accommodations. I always take my family with me over there. Been back over there 8 times, and she's always provided us accommodation. Beautiful lady, and a concert singer. You ought to hear her sing Amazing Grace. That don't bring any tears to your eyes. As our former mayor would say, your wood is wet.
You know, and it really is amazing. Vern has friends all over the world because he has such a heart to serve. And he's tied up loose ends with some of the guys he served with. He's returned items to the widows of guys who died in his unit. He's visited the graves of everyone that he personally saw die in the war. He's just an incredible example of going above and beyond and showing the kind of Christ-like love that we can all emulate. But I want to hear about when you were that guy. There was a pretty special reason that you were motivated to go serve in Europe. there was somebody who was over there that you were hoping could come home. Why don't you tell me about that?
That's my brother.
Yeah.
My brother preceded me over by a couple of months, and I had no idea where he was. I just knew he went overseas. And less than 2 months later, I was on my way overseas, and we both were infantrymen. He was Air Force, and after some of you veterans will know this, if you're familiar with the landing at Normandy, our casualty rate just began to soar because we were all over the place. We were millions of guys coming over there, and our casualty rate went up. They took him out of the Air Force and placed him in the infantry. He carried a BAR, the Browning Automatic Rifle, which was a dynamite to the Germans. They couldn't understand how a guy could carry something that could fire so fast and be right up in front, and something he could carry. So my brother carried a BAR. He was wounded and captured on the day I left for overseas. This took months to figure out all of this stuff because he didn't know where I was. I didn't know where he was. But just less than 3 weeks before he was liberated, my mom and dad received a notice from the government that he was now a prisoner of war. Before that, he was considered MIA or KIA, missing in action or killed in action, because there was nobody knew where he was. But he was in a prisoner of war camp, and on Easter Sunday, one of our tanks came into the town where he was up on where this prisoner of war camp was, and they met a German there who spoke perfect English, and he said, "I don't know if you GIs know it, but this is an open city. We have declared that we would not fire or offer any resistance to the Americans. This is an open city." And he said, "By the way, there's a prisoner of war camp here." And the tanker said, "Where is it?" And he said, "It's up on top of the hill." He said, I'll lead you up there." And this tank and a Jeep, they went up to where this was and actually knocked the fence down. And I've got pictures showing guys coming up, crawling on the tanks brought them their freedom. My brother did not go outside. He'd been told by a guard, he said, "We're going to leave. Guards were going to take off." And he said, "But if we catch any of you guys out here trying to escape, we'll kill you right on the spot." Now, my brother was married, already had a son, and he thought, you know, maybe I better just sit still. But the next day came a whole division in force and liberated him. But
which division?
I'm sorry?
Which division liberated him?
The 44th Infantry Division. Actually, the tank that liberated him was a unit that I served in, 2nd Cavalry. This tank had strayed off course, and that's easy done over there. If any of you have been in Europe, you know their roads don't go north and south or east and west. They maneuver all around. This tank had got off course and wound up in this town. I have met guys who told me about this incident, because how nearby to that camp that day I was, I don't know, because until my brother was liberated, repatriated, went home, we didn't have iPads and all this other kind of stuff. It was, you communicated totally different. By mail, you know, and some letters took six days, some of them took 6 weeks to get us to it. So anyway, through this time of maybe 5 to 6 months, I finally found out the story. And then one day, one of my guys, we went out on the parade ground. This was after the war was over. He said, "See this here?" He says, "We broke through one day with a tank and knocked a fence down into a POW camp." I said, "Really?" That didn't mean a thing to me until my brother told me the story. And then I read it in a book and saw a picture. And I said, you know, amazing how some of this stuff's happened. And this man, just a walking site, he knows these stories inside now. I would not need to be here. He knows my story.
Oh, please. There's a very important reason you're here. Because, I mean, the reality is, guys Vern's age aren't going to be here forever. And if we don't take the opportunity to ask them some questions and listen to those answers, we're going to miss out on a lot of stuff. And we could be here all day with some of Vern's stories, but I do want to get a couple more. And I want you to note this jacket he's wearing. It's the American Ex-Prisoners of War. That's an organization that exists all over the country, and there are local chapters. Vern wasn't a prisoner. His brother was. But he saw a need, and he has done an incredible job. He's been such a huge blessing to so many of these people. He's changed their lives. And I don't know about you guys, but when I'm in my 90s, I want to be going as strong as he is and look as good as he does. And I think, in my mind, as I see his example, the reason that he's so full of energy is he's been focused on serving others for so long. So I just want to sneak that in there. But I want you to tell us about your church in Reedley, because you grew up in Reedley, and when you and your brother and all these other boys went off to war, there's something that they did that's a pretty cool story.
There was about 40 of us from a little church in Reedley that were either called, enlisted, or whatever, wound up in World War II, both in the Pacific and in Europe. And as each one went off to war, there was a big plaque up in front by the on the side of the pulpit there, and they would put a name and a star by it, and then people began to pray for George Smith and George Johnson and Vern Smith and Glenn and so forth as we went off, and they would also bring us up front and have a prayer over us as we went. But in that church, there was a 24-hour prayer chain. Someone was on their knees praying for us 40 guys 24 hours a day in their home. They would get out of bed at 11 at night or 2 in the morning, get on their knees and pray specifically for us guys. Every single one came home. Every single one. My brother was, I think, the only prisoner of war. Many of them were wounded. My brother was wounded without any medical help at all. He slowly recovered in the POW camp, but many of them were wounded, but every single one came home. A real testimony to urgent prayer and what prayer can do. As your pastor was saying a while ago, there's no limit or there's no boundaries with God, and I was in the woods one night, well, I should say not by myself. We were in the woods stumbling around there in the dark, and the Germans knew exactly where we were because we were pushing them daily eastward, and they knew exactly where we were, and somebody had either lit a cigarette or a flashlight just like that, and it gave our position away, and they began throwing in mortars, and I stumbled around there trying to find a place that maybe had a foxhole or a dip or something with that I could lay down in and be below the surface of the ground. And I stumbled into something, but it was just a shallow little hole. Momentarily, I began to hear the mortars come in, and one landed probably 6-8 feet away from me, but it didn't explode. But it threw dirt all over me and, scared the daylights out of me. But I got to thinking, I would not be here today if that would have been a live one. And months later, we had, not prisoners, but Jewish people who had been in prisoner of war camps, not in concentration camps, excuse me. There's a difference between a prisoner of war camp and a concentration camp. These guys were working with us in the kitchen, and one of them could speak a little English. He came up to me and he says, "Smitty," he said, "my job as a prisoner, I worked in a munitions factory and making explosives for the German." And he said, "Inside we wanted to do something for you, not for them." And he said, "So we decided we could, if we just in secrecy, as we're putting shells or explosive together, we would leave out a little spring or a little screw that was in the firing device. If we leave that out, it would be a dud. It would not go off. And he said, of course, if we were caught with that, we would be killed immediately. So he said, we would place that inside our mouth and keep it in our mouth till we got out from the day and then spit that thing out. And he says, maybe I left a screw out on that one that landed by you. But these are just the stories that you see. The inside, they were a captive, but outside, they wanted to show the Americans that we love you. We want to do something for you. So this is just a thrill to try to and meet. And over the years, I've met people that I actually, to them, and there was their liberator on a death march. So.
Yeah, really, we could be here all day with some of these stories. Like I say, that's a great story. How he met people that he liberated. His division liberated a concentration camp in Germany. And just that story right there, as I listened to you tell it, about this Jewish prisoner who's sabotaging the German munitions. I mean, think about that. What would your perspective be in that situation? Pretty helpless feeling, right? You may lose hope, but there's always something you can do if you keep your perspective in the right place. You know, if we're always looking at our circumstances and letting that shape our view of God or life, it's going to be different than if we're viewing them through the lens of God. And there are differences that he makes every day. There's something that some prisoner did somewhere that may have saved his life and the reason he's here today. God's plans are always better than ours, for sure. And I want you guys to hear a little bit from his brother. His brother's no longer with us, but you're going to see a picture of his brother Glenn holding his helmet, which they amazingly found in the same bunker where he was captured 30 years after World War II when they went back to Germany. How crazy is that? But he's holding the helmet. You'll see two bullet holes in there. One bullet came in the helmet, didn't penetrate the liner, went back out. So that's why his brother survived. But you're going to hear a little bit of his brother's voice from when he was in prison camp, and then you're going to hear one of his fellow prisoners talking about something Vern's brother Glenn did that I think will inspire all you guys. So let's listen to that real quick.
Just before you were nearly killed with that bullet and then eventually captured, you got a letter from home.
Yes, sir.
What did your dad have to say to you that really hit home for you?
It's the only letter I can remember in all the time that I was over there that I had received from my father. My father was not a writer of letters, I can tell you that. He wrote a portion of the 91st Psalm, the 7th verse, where it says, "A thousand shall fall at thy side, 10,000 at thy right hand, and shall not come nigh thee." After I read that letter and we were told to go out on this patrol, I asked the fellows to take off their helmets and bow in a moment of prayer, which we did. I'm so thankful I did at that time because, like I say, or have told, there are some that did not survive.
A lot of the men in this building that I was in, there were 3,000 Americans, but there were 300 men in the barracks I was in. A lot of the men gave up hope, and they thought that it was a question of not when they would get liberated, but how long they could survive in this environment. Some of these men turned their face to the wall and didn't communicate with the rest of us. They kind of daydreamed the day away, and sure enough, they became the first to pass away or die. One night, there was a big, strong voice came out and said, "I shall recite to you the 23rd Psalm." And this voice began to do that. There was quite a few, non-believers in the crowd. There was quite a few boos and catcalls, but this strong voice recited the 23rd Psalm and some other things from the New Testament, sang some songs, it was almost like a miracle that barracks became very, very quiet and attentive. You could hear a pin drop. This voice kept this up night after night, and so the lights were out. 300 men crowded there. I couldn't put a face to it. During the daytime, I spent 3 or 4 days. I wandered through the crowd of people that were in our barracks, talking to different people, and I would excuse myself and go on and talk to another person. Finally, I located the owner of that voice, and that was Glenn Smith of the 42nd Infantry Division.
So I know that was kind of hard to understand. That's an old clip, and it was that veteran calling in when I was interviewing Vern's brother to surprise him. But if you didn't understand that, this is a guy who's saying, we prisoners were giving up hope, and then a voice in the night in this prison camp where they're freezing and starving starts proclaiming the 23rd Psalm and then leading them in hymns. And that was Vern's brother, Glenn, who did that and made such an impact on those other prisoners. So I just wanted to share that with you. So many examples of faith in the midst of trial. And I don't know about you guys, but that fires me up, especially when I compare those situations to what we think is adversity in our own lives. Did you have something you're going to say there, Vern?
I've been in Dr. Pascal's home in Wichita.
The guy who was just talking. Yep.
Yeah. He came to a reunion, and Dr. Pascal did, and I believe it was in Florida or someplace back there. And my brother had already been in there and was talking to somebody, and Dr. Pascal walked in. He had never met my brother. They only knew each other by hearing. Dr. Pascal in the camp heard my brother singing after he would talk and read out of the New Testament to the guys, and Dr. Pascal would hear him, and my brother would say, "Let's sing." So they'd sing the old Rugged Cross or some songs that we learned in church. And when Dr. Pascal walked into this reunion, he knew Glenn by letters, by phone, and all this good stuff, but they had never met. And he walked in and he heard a guy talking. He said, "That's Glenn. I remember his voice." Now, this is years later, you know, but he remembered his voice. He walked up to him. He said, "You're Glenn Schmidt." He said, "Yeah." He said, "I'm Dr. Pascal." And here these guys have been friends for years and years and never had met, but he remembered his voice from singing in a prisoner of war camp. Now, you know, there's something inside that held them together. You could give up hope because the food was absolutely not only terrible to eat, but almost nothing to eat. And you know, I've met these guys and some of these Jewish guys that we liberated on a death march, 10 days on a death march, heading to another concentration camp. Nothing to eat, nothing to eat. There were 11,000 of them out of the camp that we liberated. In 10 days, out of 11,000, 6,000 were dead, either by the guards shooting them or by just no more food. One fellow was 19 years old. He's since passed away. I've met him and his family at the camp reunion. His daughter came to me. She says, "I want you to meet my father because he says you are his liberator." I said, "Well, I've never met your dad." He said, "I know that." But he said, "He met you," meaning he met a GI that saved his life. He could not walk a step farther, and he knew if he couldn't walk, the guard would shoot him. And that's how they got rid of the people. If you couldn't walk and you couldn't carry anybody, you just shot him. And they dug a little trench and rolled you in, covered up with leaves or whatever. In fact, on this death march, I've seen a leg sticking out of the ground or an arm sticking out of the ground. What in the world is this? This is how they buried them. Just dug a little trench. Anyway, this guy could not walk a step farther. 19 years old, okay? He and I were the same age at that particular time. But one of his buddies propped him up and let him lean against a tree. When the guard came by, he appeared to be standing. He said, "Whew." A sigh of relief. The guard walked by, and I'm leaning against a tree. And he said, "And then you guys came." He just looked at me and he said, "I just want to thank you for saving my life." I said, "Man, you know, inside, I don't even know him." And two other guys, one was 19 and one was 13. He was dragging this little 13-year-old, and the kid said, "I can't go one step farther." And the 19-year-old fella said, "Hey, today, I know the Americans are going to come today. We've been hearing their shells come over. We know they're close by. Hang with me." And the little kid was just reluctant. But he said, just a short time, here came a Jeep out of the woods. He said, "We saw that great big white star on the side." Said, "Oh, here they are." And the guy pulled up to his to these two kids and said, "Hey, kids, get in. For you, the war is over." I've been in the home of both these fellas. Well, the 19-year-old is no longer with us. He was a businessman up in Modesto. The other one lives in New York. I've been in his home. And I say probably by the time I get home, there might be a phone call from him. He always calls. He said, I want to talk to my liberator. You can't argue with him. I said, I don't even know you, Steve. He says, yeah, but I know who you are because you saved my life. But these guys, and I've been so privileged to meet so many of them. In 2015, they had their 70th anniversary of the liberation of Flossenbürg concentration camp, one of three along the, there was Buchenwald, and then about a two-hour drive is Flossenbürg, and then another two-hour drive is Dachau, all in one line like this. And they were coming out of Buchenwald, Flossenbürg, and Dachau. And at 2015, my son and I were there, and you could not believe that there was people from all over the world, either families or the person who was liberated and his wife and family. And the director there is a personal friend of mine. I had been there and invited him one year to come to one of our 90th division reunions, and he did come and gave his story of the concentration camp. He was introducing different dignitaries who have been helping make this place a living testimony. It's now like an educational facility. It's just a beautiful place. And he was introducing them. And then he said, we have one World War II veteran here who was here on April 23rd, 1945, when this was liberated. And he said, Vern, would you please stand up? And I stood up, and the people clapped. Immediately, a line formed. People stood up. About 20 people stood up, all my age. I was 89, I believe, at that time, something like that. And they all lined up, and one by one came and threw their arms around me, just volunteering. I mean, I could not understand. My son looked back there and said, Dad, you're a hero. I said, no, I just showed up. But these guys, men and women both, came and threw their arms around me and said, you saved my life. You never know the horror and the torture that these people went through for no reason at all. They might have been a Christian, they might have been a doctor, but they were not in sympathy with Hitler's regime. Even his own people, he killed his own German people. He had Erwin Rommel, the desert fox, who was just like General Patton, had him put to death. You know, demonic to say. But we Americans stood tall because a good portion of us had the love of God inside our heart. We knew these people needed help.
Well, and if there's anything I know about you, it's that you have the love of God in your heart, because we see it every day in how you live and what you do for others. And if they can come up to him in Europe and recognize what he and other Americans did for their freedom and give him a big hug, I think we can give a pretty big thank you to Vern Schmidt today here at the Well, right?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And I know some of you guys would stay here for a few more hours, but some of you have to get to work, so I'm going to turn it back over to Brad. Just make sure, you saw some guys raise their hands today that said they served our country. Take a moment to thank them today, and if you have time, ask them about it. Find out when they served, where they served, some of the things they did. It means a lot to them. But thanks again for letting us bend your ear a little bit.
Thank you, Brad.
Sir, thank you. So glad you're here.
How about that? Well, there's not much to add to that, but let me share one scripture passage and frame our time, and we'll sneak out of here. In Hebrews chapter 11, the author of Hebrews is talking about what some have called the Hall of Faith. Think of it like the greatest of greats of biblical heroes that we see in our Bible. Not always perfect people, but people that God chose to use in profound ways. On the heels of a list of the heroes who did miraculous things, faithful things, who just showed up sometimes and may not have felt impressive, but God used them. The author of Hebrews says this, therefore, in response to those who've gone before us as examples or heroes of the faith, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles, and let us run with endurance the race set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated now at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and you will not lose heart. We are not only in the presence, from a spiritual standpoint, of spiritual greatness with the men and women that God has used in the Bible, but we're in the presence of greatness of a man who just chose to show up and be faithful one day at a time. And fellas, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses, could we also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles? And could we just run with endurance the race set before us? Which might mean, fellas, we just keep showing up and we just keep walking it out. And we just keep faithfully picking ourselves up when we fall, picking up our brothers when we fall. But we lock arms together and say, together we're going to pursue Jesus. And it's not always pretty. And it's not always impressive, but if we'll just keep showing up, God will use us. And so let's be faithful to that today. As we celebrate this Veterans Day, let's remember those who've gone before. Just be grateful. Be grateful. All gave some, and some gave all. And let's remember that today. And it gives me hope today, knowing the stains that our country has experienced in the past. It gives me hope today to know that we're not defined by that. But the gospel makes us new as individual men, and we can live out the ideals that this country was really established to be about and to live out. And so let me pray for us, and we'll walk with that hope as we leave today. God, we thank you for who you are, for the gospel that redeems us and saves us from ourselves. And God, we confess that oftentimes we are broken vessels, that as we're walking out this Christian faith, sometimes we stumble and we fall. Could we have the courage, based on those who've gone before, to get up, dust ourselves off, and just keep showing up? And could we love one another enough that we don't leave anyone behind, but we grab one another, we pick each other up, and we walk this thing out together? That, Father, we thank you that you have not called us to yourself just individually, but you've united us as brothers in pursuit of Christ from multiple churches all over this great city to live out the gospel, to show people Jesus, and to be faithful one day at a time. So in the midst of chaos and division, could we be faithful? In the midst of people online popping off and saying things that are divisive, could we be faithful? Could we show preference to one another in honor? Could we consider others as more important than ourselves? And in that, could we keep the cross first? And so, Lord, we'll thank you for today. Thank you for the great stories that were shared and for those who've gone before. And we'll thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. All right, fellas, next month we will be back here. And what a treat today. Thank you, guys. Give these guys a hand one more time, will you? So grateful. So if you need to sneak out and head to work, jump out of here. If you want to stay and hang out, you're welcome to hang out. We're going to turn this place over. We got a church gathering here on Thursday, so we're going to turn this place over in a little bit. Hey, Mike, do we have some burritos over there? All right, we got extra burritos. Take them to your family or your office. God bless you guys. We'll see you next month.